We don't expect that sort of stuff to happen to us, but, you know, cyber fraud and scams and those sorts of things, they work at an industrial level. There are literally office buildings full of people who do nothing all day apart from perpetrate those sorts of crimes and those sorts of frauds. Yeah. And we're not immune to that. We fall into the trap of like, oh, yeah, we're a small country. You know, nobody's going to really care about us too much. But as you said up front, you know, we're as connected as everybody else.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.
Hey folks, greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. Great to have with us Dan Richardson today from CyberCX. Great to see you.
Great to be here, Paul. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Always good to have listeners joining us on the show. And look, Dan, cybersecurity is something that I think a lot of us are very interested in. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, a real privilege to have you join the show and share some of your insights. Maybe, you know, quick overview of where you fit into this big wide world of cyber in New Zealand.
Yeah. So currently, I'm the executive director of strategy and risk at CyberCX New Zealand. So CyberCX is a pure cybersecurity company. We do cloud as well, but in a very secure way. So we do the full end-to-end spectrum of cybersecurity services, right through from strategy consulting through to penetration testing, digital forensics, incident response, managed services, those types of things. So we've got our clients covered.
Basically. Great. That's really good. And you previously sort of worked, you know, in a range of places kind of across the industry. You were a chief information security officer at Westpac. Previously, a little bit of work for the Spooks. GCSB.
Very proud of my time at the National Cybersecurity Center. But I think I was telling you before we started that I caught up with a friend last week and we were having a chat, and he said, "Oh, I remember, you know, 1999 when we were working in London together, and you used to sit there and send my Windows PC the ping of death." Yeah. And at the most inopportune times, and I turn around and you sit there and you were laughing. So I've been doing cybersecurity for a while now, and I've been around, so lots of corporates, obviously in New Zealand and overseas, a bit of time in government, about 5 years at the National Cybersecurity Center, which was great team there, and then about 3.5 years at Westpac as a chief information security officer, before joining CyberCX.
Oh, very cool. And Drizzy, I had a little bit of time. It's actually quite a small window of time in London in 1999, and did some stuff with a bank there.
Great time to be
here. Y2K days. So before we start, of course, a big thank you to our show partners, 1NZ, 2Degrees, Spark, HP, and Guerrilla Technology. Lots I'm definitely keen to delve into on the cybersecurity front, but it'd be good just to tap in on some of the recent news. Mm-hmm. New Zealand Defence Force, they're testing some hardware that's gone up into orbit. I think it's you know really interesting and you know, I guess, depending on the perspectives, that you come from on, I guess, the defence element of space. But in general, I guess, you know, to me, it's pleasing to see New Zealand, you know, as a country from a commercial perspective and from, you know, other perspectives that we're getting involved in the world of space sort of more and more. Lots of companies here that are involved in aerospace and in space.
I was talking to a colleague in Australia a couple of weeks ago, actually.
And,
the comparison between the Australian space industry and the New Zealand space industry, that's something we're beating the Aussies, so let's keep doing that.
Well, it's interesting to see on that front because it does seem as though in Australia, the government have put their foot to the floor more. So whilst New Zealand have, you know, had quite quite a lead with, I guess on a number of fronts, but you know, Rocket Lab probably, being the biggest, most well known, part of our sector. I think in a way that's kind of put a rocket under some of the Australians,
yeah,
and they're
agree.
Like, we don't like Kiwis beating us, and actually if there's money New Zealand can make, we should be able to make at least as much, and so, you know, I think there's probably a level of friendly rivalry in that area, and you know, I'm sure it will continue. I think what we're seeing with a space minister and you know, some of the direction that we're seeing from the current government, this is taking on a more important role, yeah, at a government level. So I think that is just something that, you know, hopefully keeps heading in a good direction, because I think our ability as a nation to be able to generate more export revenue and do more work, as it relates to space and you know, the broader aerospace segment, is, you know, generally a pretty good thing for our country and for the economy.
It's really cool to see as well, you know, especially with Rocket Lab, but other companies as well, the interest in STEM that brings for like a younger generation.
Yeah,
super cool.
Yeah, I think, yeah, when you see these you know, possibilities that actually, hey, you can go from studying in a New Zealand school and end up in a space company.
Exactly,
it's not such a far-fetched thing as, you know, I remember when I was growing up and there was one of my brother's friends, and he was, you know, telling me his friend's dad was, you know, had been working for NASA. And I mean, that was not a common story to hear around New Zealand, to have some sort of connection back to NASA.
Yeah, it seemed so distant back in the 80s, 70s and 80s. It seemed very, very distant. But now we have our own space industry, and it's so good.
Yeah, really, really pleasing. So without sort of, yeah, delving into the politics of Defence Force and so on, but I think it's pretty encouraging overall where we're headed. Now, another thing that caught my attention, this was an article from Susan Edmonds and Stuff saying Westpac introducing fraud busting technology, but only in Australia. So we might just leave the headline there and come back to it once we start delving a bit more into cybersecurity, because it sort of sits in that broader area. But it's a scam busting technology called SaferPay, which would add additional, you know, screening on, you know, basically on every payment that's flowing through Westpac, utilizing artificial intelligence. And so, yeah, there's probably a discussion to be had there. And I know, you know, not just from your Westpac experience, but your other sort of connections across the banking world, you could probably share some thoughts on that front. But yeah, it might just be that there's a bit of a trend with what New Zealand gets versus what Australia gets in some cases. So looking at some of the things happening on a global front, Neuralink, that's been kind of crazy to kind of see what, you know, I guess when we first heard about it, and I don't know about you, Dan, but, you know, this idea of sort of brain implants, and we've known a few companies doing it, but, you know, Musk tends to be able to get the attention and get the headlines.
Yep.
And as you say, and get stuff done, but I'm not sure that I've sort of had really too much anticipation that we were going to see anything anytime soon. But you know, here we are, where, you know, their first human patient, you know, has already been sort of, you know, touting the technology. 29-year-old Noland Arbor, I'm not quite sure if I've got his name pronounced right, but. He's got the implant, and away he goes, and he's able to, you know, play chess online and the like. As a quadriplegic by controlling a game from the computer.
I'm not sure I want to be the test subject for it. Put it that way. But look, if he's, you know, obviously with his medical condition, getting something out of it, then you know, there's a net positive there already. So, you know, I think it's probably a long way from general adoption, obviously, you know, good 20, 30 years plus realistically by the time it gets to market and gets through all those regulatory hurdles. But definitely something to keep an eye on. And yeah, for those with a, you know, chronic medical condition or issues like that, then absolutely, why wouldn't we use technology to kind of help those people?
Yeah, and it seems to me it's for those, you know, for those edge cases, and, you know, of course we can throw around ideas of, you know, how this stuff could be used if it was available sort of mainstream. And, you know, I think most of us have seen The Matrix, and, you know, there's enough out there to
The Matrix too many times.
To freak us out if we, you know, if we want to go down the rabbit hole. But, yeah, I think just in many ways it just sort of blows my mind that this thing has happened, you know, quite quickly. Mm. Obviously, you know, what it can do and how accurate it is and how useful it is. These are things that we will see evolve exactly. Over, you know, as you say, it could be quite a long, long period of time. You know, there would be an argument, and, you know, I don't know how advanced the technology is, that it's not a million miles off some of these sort of headset-y type things that you can wear. Definitely, you know, the next level from, I've tried out some of that sort of technology and it kind of, you know, pretty rudimentary, pretty simple. That it, you know, it's a step along from that, but it's not the sort of thing where it's reading your thoughts and able to, you know, squirt them out with an AI voice, right?
It opens up some interesting cybersecurity questions as well. You know, you look at any piece of software or hardware out there, there's many vulnerabilities. You know, are there vulnerabilities in these things? How do you patch them? How do you deal with them? So, yeah, that's a real consideration.
Just a Band-Aid on the brain, mate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a. I guess it will be one of those points that I imagine someone is already looking at how they can, how they can exploit the technology. Now, AI, we're seeing this kind of move towards, you know, buying training data, and there's, you know, been a, you know, a bunch of sort of coverage on this front. It seems as though there's almost a kind of a shaming going on for those who are utilizing information that's sort of publicly available. And, you know, there was you know, been coverage and in recent days around OpenAI training on YouTube. There's a range of sort of licensing agreements and so on getting you know, fired up so that AI companies, AI providers can be using content sort of legitimately. It's kind of a challenging one, because I can see how an organization that's got a great AI just wants to kind of, you know, suck up the data that they can find that's publicly accessible and just say, look, it's, you know,
this is just
like a search engine, or just like a, you know, it's just replacing a human, but it can remember a whole lot of stuff. Any you know, perspectives on you know, where you think we should be going here is you know, fast sort of legislation useful? What, you know?
Yeah, I'm not an AI expert. I'm just a humble security guy. So, you know, I've had thoughts and feelings like everybody else does. But if you point a large language learning model at an existing set of data, of course you're going to get similar outcomes, right? Mm. Like AI, as we know, is not great at anticipating black swan type events. You know, expect the unexpected. So things that the human mind can conceptualize, AI really struggles to, because for exactly that reason, as you said, like you pointed at a particular set of data, you're going to get a very similar outcome. It will think that that's all it knows. So I can fully understand why everybody, you know, people who are training these models might want to push that out to a much, much broader set of data. But even then, I think you're still going to run into issues, right? Like if you're pointing it at, I don't know, YouTube or X/Twitter, you're going to hoover up a lot of bot content, And is that really the stuff that you want regurgitated back out from your AI? I don't think so. So all of these considerations, you know, we have to take into account.
Yeah, and the challenge of, you know, how good and robust the sources are, the differing sort of viewpoints on you know varying information that's available online. You know, we're all probably, you know, unique in terms of what it is we read and consume and we're interested in and so on, you know, and the perspectives through you know how we look at things, right?
Yeah.
You'll read a headline, I'll read a headline. We will, you know, we might you know take quite different viewpoints on what that means. You read the article and it's like, well, oh, that makes sense, and you know I might look at it and go, well, that doesn't make much sense to me, and so on. So you know when you mash all of that sort of stuff together. The outcomes can be, you know, sometimes just super useful and helpful for everyone. Sometimes it doesn't play out well. You know, we saw that with some of sort of Google Alphabet's, you know, AI things recently where they've tried to sort of, you know, nudge it in differing directions. Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, ended up going off the reservation. And I think you kind of see that with pretty much every platform to one degree or another is going to upset people, you know, in differing ways.
I mean, I watch a lot of YouTube, like most people do, and I'm really into architecture. So the YouTube algorithm is really good at giving me interesting architecture videos.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't account for the fact that, you know, sometimes after a glass of wine on a Wednesday night, I might watch Love Island on TVNZ.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're discrete individuals.
Yeah.
And, you know, we might use one platform for one thing, which is giving you a set of data that points to a particular thing, but actually we've missed a whole bunch, you know? So yeah, we really need to take that into consideration.
And then there's the, you know, what should or shouldn't we be paying for?
Mm.
And so yeah, should we be utilizing, you know, or should AI platforms only be utilizing you know, sources that they pay for? Do you say, well, this is public, an individual could go and read these, you know, these news sources and, yeah, you know, could watch any video and so on. Right. And yeah, you see there's all sorts of, you know, potential for drama in that front. And we've already heard around, yeah, potential court cases and so on.
Yeah, from a legal perspective, regulatory perspective, yeah, you know, just access to those data sets, it's a minefield.
Yeah. All right. Well, those was kind of, I guess, the big newsy topics for the week, and there's probably a bunch more we had down there we could delve into. But I'm keen to chat more around cybersecurity. This is very much your you know your world, and because I think, you know, cybersecurity is so important, you know, to each of us individually. We don't want bad things happening to our organisations, and therefore it has a flow on to, you know, to New Zealand, you know, as a whole. We get things wrong from a cyber, you know, perspective. You know, it's kind of like having a hole in the boat, right?
You can
sink, and we certainly don't want our economy and our people to be sinking because we've been taken advantage of from a cybersecurity perspective. So that kind of, I guess, you know, puts us almost in a view of New Zealand versus the world. We're this little country sort of towards the bottom of the planet. However, we're online like everyone else is.
As connected as everybody else.
We can be under attack. Yet there's only ever going to be a sort of certain capacity when it comes to, you know, what the government of a sort of smaller country can, you know, can invest from a cyber security perspective. And because we have a lot of sort of smaller and medium organisations, you know, those organisations are only ever, you know, maybe going to have access to you know, probably a lighter levels of investment, you know, compared to the bigger players. And, you know, we certainly see a range of geopolitical issues going on in the world, where we've, you know, we've got wars, we've got economic dramas, and then we've got our neighbours in Australia who are just that much, you know, bigger than us. And so there's that, I guess, debate of, you know, how we're doing versus our Aussie cousins or whatever you want to call them.
Our good friends across the ditch.
Yeah. So I think there's a few things we could sort of delve into there. Maybe this Australia versus, you know, New Zealand side, because on the New Zealand Tech Podcast, when we launched, one of the things that was happening was that the government had decided to invest, I think at the time it was $1.5 billion into fibre infrastructure for New Zealand. Now that's increased and, you know, we've ended up with, where are we at, something like 87% of the population with access to you know, superb broadband and varying other options for the other 13%. And in Australia, you know, I would politely say they've been trying to catch up ever since.
It's been a bit slower, yeah.
But on the cyber front, you could argue that shoe's maybe on the other foot a little bit. What are your thoughts on you know, how we're doing in this area, particularly from the realms that you've worked in, you know, banking and government and so on?
That's a really interesting question. And the way I always kind of look at it is, you know, Australia, much bigger country, much bigger economy. Absolutely, and I don't want to sort of, you know, get fixated on what they're doing as our close friends and neighbours. But, you know, CyberCX is a trans-Tasman organisation. We work with organisations in New Zealand. We work with Australian organisations as well. And we sort of see, obviously, there's quite a different regulatory environment in Australia, and that drives a lot of cybersecurity investment. So you think about things like in Security of Critical Infrastructure Act that they have in Australia. Mandates, you know, minimum standards. They can designate systems as systems of national significance, which, you know, have extra protections wrapped around them. We don't have that equivalent kind of regulatory or policy setting within New Zealand. And that means that, you know, you can operate a reasonably important bit of critical infrastructure for the country, but there's no minimum cybersecurity standards that you have to meet for your technology. And that obviously puts us at a slight disadvantage compared to Australia. I'm not sort of saying that, you know, we're underinvesting necessarily, but actually you kind of look at things, even in recent budgets in Australia, they put a whole heap of money into their national, you know, cybersecurity defenses. Red Spice was the name of the program, but they've also partnered up with Microsoft for Cyber Shield. The New Zealand government is still kind of lagging behind a little bit with some of that. And you know, obviously we've had a change of government that may change things. But yeah, it's quite a different environment here compared to Australia.
Yeah. I mean, they've had a minister of cybersecurity, haven't they?
And a
range of other things. I guess you could say the legislation there as it relates to cybersecurity and data privacy, tends to be more mature
there's some
teeth there in some of the legislation, which is at a different sort of level to ours, certainly on the data privacy side.
Yeah, I compare the responses to, you know, last year in Australia, they had some issues, Optus, Medibank, Latitude Financial Services, all suffered cyber incidents. And that was headline news in Australia for a good couple of weeks.
Yeah. And they were being called out by the government.
They were
right?
being called
so
out in
like
Parliament.
Really big
time.
Yeah.
Very forward leaning. And, you know, only one of those organizations operates in New Zealand, you know, Latitude Financial. And the Privacy Commissioner in New Zealand is having a joint investigation with their Australian counterparts, which is great thing to do. But it dropped out of the news cycle in New Zealand very, very quickly. And we've seen that recently with MediaWorks as well. You know, they had a data breach and it was in the news on the Friday. By the Monday, it had completely gone. So, you know, our sort of, not necessarily level of interest, but, you know, the amount of airtime that it gets in the media is quite different here compared to Australia as well. So maybe that slight, you know, drives slightly different behaviours.
Yeah, it's a really big point, actually, I think, and that the more airtime that we give these things, the more we're likely to, you know, think about them, attend to them, and so on. And, yeah, I think that was something that has been really super visible in those cases. For those that are comparing, you know, the media on both sides, it is night and day different when it comes to these sorts of issues. And I guess that comes from, you know, varying perspectives. Certainly the emphasis that we see from a government level and the government really calling out these organisations and holding them to account, there being, you know, enough of a you know, solid enough sort of legislation that really puts quite a bit of weight on these entities. So when something happens, there's going to be a big fallout, not just from the media perspective, but then that sort of that tends to come along
in terms of fines as well, and penalties as well. Yeah. You know, quite different.
Yeah.
In terms of you look at you know, some of the provisions that I think it was Medibank had to put into their financial statements as potentially, you know, money to compensate victims of their data breach. It was hundreds of millions of dollars. And we don't see that same level of response here at all.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you look at, say, Latitude with what, you know, what happened there, you know, I can't quite remember what the you know, the impact was on them in terms of what they would do. But it wasn't a lot in terms of, certainly here in New Zealand, in terms of what the cost was, sort of, you know, per person impacted.
Yeah.
But it seemed to be a lot, probably a lot higher.
That's
on
right.
the Australian side.
Yeah, for
a number of reasons. And the expectations when something happens as well in Australia. So, you know, if an organisation leaks a whole lot of personal data, then they're really having to sort of, you know, step up and, you know, pay for a range of services. It might be pay for a new driver's license.
New passport,
so you've got, you know, new ID documents with different, you know, numbers and so on, so that, you know, what has been taken in the breach then can't be used against an individual. Mm. On this side, I don't even know whether we've had really addressed a lot of these things. I remember, you know, last time a while back looking at this with driver's licenses, and I think the you know, the New Zealand thing was like, no, you're fine, you just keep your driver's license. It wasn't it was like, no, we don't have a route for you to be able to change your driver's license.
No, there is no
if you want
way
one in New Zealand, it's like, sorry mate, good luck, this stuff can just remain online for the next 10 years until when your driver's license expires or something.
I think I'm right in saying if you lose your driver's license, you just get an exact replica of the one you
with had a reissue before, numbers on. So there's maybe a little bit of work to do behind the scenes there if we're going to you know, if we're going to be in a place where we're not taken advantage of, because there's a degree to, you know, these sort of, you know, settings ultimately impacting behavior, isn't there? And it's not like as Kiwis we're all sort of she'll be right mate on these topics, but there probably is a kind of a down under kind of approach that would be impacted, you know, likewise in Australia, is impacted by if there are regulatory sort of pressures and legislation that says you're going to get hit this way or that way if you don't have things in place, that changes the picture a bit.
We're also quite a trusting group of people in this country, I would say. You know, we trust not necessarily, you know, just our banks and our civic institutions, but, you know, individually we're quite, you know, trust each other.
Yeah.
Maybe a lot more than in some other countries.
Very low from a fraud perspective.
Yeah. So we don't expect that sort of stuff to happen to us. But, you know, as we all know, fraud, you know, especially sort of cyber fraud and scams and those sorts of things, they work at an industrial level. So, you know, there are literally office buildings full of people who do nothing all day apart from perpetrate those sorts of crimes and those sorts of frauds.
Yeah.
And we're not immune to that. And I think we sort of, we fall into the trap of like, oh yeah, we're a small country, you know, nobody's going to really care about us too much. But as you said up front, you know, we're as connected as everybody else. So we suffer, you know, from the same sorts of threats and the same sorts of issues. So we need to kind of think about that as well from a global perspective.
Now, we've sort of talked about, you know, New Zealand, you know, versus Australia as it were, which is, you know, I guess it's good to have those chats sometimes, and even if it's just to remind ourselves, you know, maybe we're not as good as we would like to be. But if we step back and kind of, you know, look at the whole world, there are certain, you know, parts of the world that are probably more focused on outgoing attacks, you know, whether it's nation state type things or for just general financial gain. You know, North Korea often sort of comes up as a place that, you know, probably struggles to earn a lot from an export revenue perspective. And so, you know, for them, this is something that can really move the
money spinner,
move the needle, right?
Yeah,
they can generate all sorts of
and beat sanctions at the same time.
So, yeah. bypass everything. So, what can you sort of share from your experiences without giving away, you know, too many secrets from inside, you know, some of the environments where you may well have seen things that that you're not supposed to talk too much about, but you know, around that sort of overall, you know, those international sort of threats and what stands out.
That's a great question, and actually something I was reflecting on a few weeks ago, because like I said, I've been in cybersecurity a long time, and there must be something kind of keeping me interested. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. I would have gone and become a farmer or something. But I kind of look at it as a bit of a layer cake. So you think of the top layer of cyber threats as, you know, those nation state actors, you know, they're destructive, you know, they might take down your ports or your critical infrastructure. And then there's another layer down, which is the sort of, again, state actors, but they're more focused on cyber espionage. And, you know, you look at espionage now, especially signals intelligence, and it essentially is just computer hacking. Now, you know, the days of the stuff that Edward Snowden talked about, you know, mass collect on, you know, internet access points, you know, encryption is not ubiquitous, but it's ubiquitous enough that, you know, that sort of data is way less useful than it used to be. And there are still some specialized applications around, you know, RF and HF radio and those sorts of things, are being able to track ships, and that's great.
Sure.
But you think about espionage and you sort of think, well, how do you get data remotely? Course you're going to hack into somebody's system and get it, and that's just, you know, how the world does espionage now, and we're not immune to that. You know, we're a country, people want to find out things about us, and we want to find out things about other countries as well, of course. And then you sort of go down in the layer cake of, you know, highly organized criminal gangs, cyber criminals that, you know, operate in certain jurisdictions in Asia and Eastern Europe and other places as well, not just those places. And they're purely driven by money. How do they monetize the cyber threats that they have access to, and how do they use some of those tools, techniques, procedures to get as much money as they can? And that's, you know, that's actually where large portions of the problem actually are. It's, you know, it's things like ransomware, you know, that's prevalent and continues to be so. Data extortion, as we've seen recently with some recent data breaches, things like fraud and scams on a massive industrial scale. And there is lots of money in it. And that's the motivation. And then you also, you know, as you get sort of layered down more into sort of the hacktivists, you know, people with an issue that they sort of want to push, that, you know, those sorts of attacks, mostly DDoS, you know, denial of service type attacks, they sort of do those sorts of things. So we saw a lot of that around the Israel-Hamas conflict, you know, people picking sides and launching denial of service attacks against, you know, infrastructure that was deemed to be supportive of one of those two sides. And that was much the same with Russia-Ukraine as well. So while there was no real sort of direct impact from a cybersecurity perspective for a country like New Zealand, a lot of the time there were flow-on effects from those denial-of-service attacks. So there's so much variety, not just in the type of actor, but the type of methodology that they use. And also, you know, their motivations as well. And that's kind of what keeps me interested. It's super interesting once you start sort of getting into it and understanding some of those things.
Yeah, it's not a boring one, that's for sure. There's always things going on. Do you, when you look at the role of AI, how do you pick where we might head over the next few years? Because, you know, from one perspective, it's like, wow, we've now got all of these sort of tools coming through from an AI perspective that can detect anomalies and so on, unusual activities that, you know, a person or, you know, a group of people could never keep up with on their own.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, you've got, you know, you've got the bad actors also have access to technology.
Yeah.
And you know, if they're able to really ramp things up with AI, which of course they are, you know, that brings its own consequences. It sort of feels like we've got, you know, something of an arms race, you know, happening.
Yeah, we totally have. And, you know, like you've been in technology long enough, Paul, as we both have, that, you know, technology is agnostic. It can be used for good things. It can be used for bad things. And AI is really no different. But we're absolutely seeing cyber threat actors use AI tools to help them in their operations. So common example, and this is happening to financial institutions around the region in Australia, New Zealand and other places, AI-generated voicemails that go to bank customers, you know, trained on a voice that they would find familiar. So, you know, most people you can find on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, you can get voice samples from people really easily. Probably doing myself a disservice by being on this podcast because that's great voice samples of me.
It's too late now.
But you can use AI tools to generate the voice of somebody that is familiar to somebody else.
Yeah.
Leave a voicemail on their phone. Oh, I'm in trouble. I need, you know, $1,000. Can you send it to my bank account? Here's my bank details. And that stuff actually happens. It seems like a bit like science fiction, but it's purely AI generated. But it's definitely going on out there. And then the flip side to that coin is, you know, we've got some great security tools that help defend against some of those things. On an enterprise level, things like, you know, Microsoft Copilot for security, they've done some great job in, you know, making a security analyst's job not necessarily easier, but being able to get through more threats, you know, much more quickly.
Yes.
So we can use that, you know, the same variety of tool for good purposes as well. So it's very much a double-edged sword, like everything is.
Mm-hmm. Now, delving into the banks, because that's a world where you've worked and I'm sure, you know, even as you in different firms, you'll have a fair bit of exposure to these things. It does seem, and I think, you know, this is sort of probably public knowledge that the New Zealand banks don't get the same, you know, probably level of investment when it comes to cyber type things as our Australian banks, and you could probably quite easily, link that back up to size, scale, and the different, you know, regulatory environment that we talked about earlier. There's been a fair bit of discussion recently around a move to verification when you're making a payment to a bank account.
Mm.
Yeah, I think we've got maybe one or two players that are sort of in the fintech sort of space, but aren't, you know, traditional banks that are able to sort of, you know, leap ahead and of the big banks and offer some sort of verification type process. So when you take some money and, I mean, we can look back on, there's probably a whole range of scenarios, but I pick on the Team New Zealand one because it was, you know, it was reasonably public, right. and Team New Zealand's of reasonably, you know, broad interest, and they got the email saying, hey, can you pay this bill into a different bank account, and I think that the story goes that Peter Dalton said, no worries, I don't care which bank account it goes into. All good. And deposited the funds. Now, there's a range of ways of sort of stopping that sort of thing. Mm. And I think, they were in a period where it maybe wasn't as broad knowledge as it is today around, you know, what your payment processes should look like. But there were lots and lots of organisations at that time that certainly, knew to have some good processes in place. But there's also that element where, you know, if your bank account is verifying your money's going into the right accounts,
that's right.
That can cut down the risk. Not necessarily entirely, but it becomes another part of the picture. What are your thoughts on, you know, how hard is it to make these sort of changes and how do you feel about the different levels of investment into our you know, banking security here versus Australia?
No, great question. Look, when I was at Westpac, I'd spend time obviously talking to the board and the board and all of the senior managers were really concerned with cyber issues and fraud and scams. And I think if you went to any financial institution in the country and talked to their board, talked to their chief executive, you'd hear exactly the same thing.
Hmm.
If cyber risk isn't, you know, in your top three risks, operational risks at a financial institution, you're probably not doing your job very well. And I would, you know, I would say that for most, if not all, you know, financial institutions in this country, you know, it would be up there in terms of the risk that they're thinking about. I suppose where the difference comes in from a New Zealand perspective is, you know, we are a lot more resource constrained than our friends in Australia. So, you know, less people, less money. The big Aussie-owned banks obviously make huge profits. And there was a recent Commerce Commission report that sort of called them out saying, you know, you need to invest more in your technology stacks in New Zealand. And, you know, I would completely agree with that because, you know, you look at some really critical applications that run in banks, and I'm not talking specifically about Westpac here, but more generally, they're running on bits of technology 20, 30 years old. You know, lots of banks still run mainframes as their main sort of core systems. And, you know, actually probably nothing wrong with that realistically. Modern mainframes are very robust. But you sort of look at it and go, well, why are we behind in the banking industry compared to Australia and certainly compared to Europe? I have an account with a European bank, and I log on to the app, and the level of security controls that I have to go through just to log on, not even transferring money.
Oh, it's like that with my Swiss bank account too.
Yeah. It's not a Swiss bank account. I wish. But it's a level above, you know, what you get from your New Zealand banking application.
Yes.
You know, lots of New Zealand banking applications don't even use multi-factor authentication. And you go, well, surely you're going to run into some problems with that, you know, not just fraud and scams, but actually more pressing problems, you know, anti-money laundering problems and those sorts of things. So there is a lag. There is a lag in the banking industry in New Zealand. And I don't think it's because, you know, people aren't focused on the problem or boards or senior executives don't take it seriously. It's more that there's a lot of legacy within banking environments, lots of legacy technology, and sometimes retrofitting, you know, good, robust security controls over some of that legacy technology is really difficult. So that's probably the biggest issue. If you look at Westpac, I think the story you were referencing might have made mention that in Australia, Westpac Australia is about to embark on a massive core banking refresh of all of their technology, all of their critical applications. And I was reading news articles about this, and I didn't see any mention of New Zealand in any of these articles. Yeah. And you go, well, actually, that's a billion-dollar bank for the New Zealand economy. So surely there has to be some commensurate level of investment on this side of the Tasman as well. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, well, interesting is one very very polite way of putting it, I would tend to say, Dan. So, yes, there's probably – well, there is a lot more I would love to go into. We're probably just about out of time. In terms of the variety of work and the, you know, things that that you've been involved in at CyberCX, you know, as a, I guess, as an external, you know, party that's working with a range of clients sort of between Australia and New Zealand, how does that sort of variety compare to your work, you know, with the national cybersecurity side of things with the NCSC and working in the banking world?
I look at all of my experiences throughout my career as a learning journey. And where I'm at now with CyberCX, I'm only successful at doing that because of the experience that I have. And I've built that experience up over a number of years. And working at CyberCX gives me the opportunity to go into different organizations and help them with their cybersecurity challenges. And that is immensely rewarding in lots of ways. You know, at a bank, great. I love my time at Westpac, love the team. But, you know, it's very, very samey, you know, day after day. And what I love about my job at the moment is I can, you know, be working with a bank one day and then, you know, a government the next day, and then a small medium enterprise, you know, out in Pakuranga, and, you know, helping them. And like, you get to see such diversity. And that's actually, you know, what really makes us strong, you know, within New Zealand is that diversity. So yeah, I'm super pumped and super happy to be there.
Now, without ensuring that you end up walking out of here in handcuffs, you know, what might people find interesting around, I guess, you know, what goes in at a government level national cybersecurity center, and you know, any things that you can share that might, you know, people might not sort of, you know, broadly know that
Look,
people find interesting?
I would say if you're a person that's interested in cybersecurity and you don't quite know where to start, but you've got some really good skills, like, it's a great place to go and learn.
Yes, yeah, I've heard that.
And it's a great place to do things that you can't do anywhere else legally in the country. but it's, you know, I loved my time down there in Wellington with the team. Had some great people, learned a lot, had some great opportunities to go to different places and work with different agencies. And, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's, you know, I think people kind of, you know, look at the public service and they look at the governments and go, oh, you know, they're just Wellington bureaucrats. And that was not my experience. And that goes, you know, for the wider cybersecurity sector within, you know, the national security system. So not just the NCSC and the GCSB, but people like DPMC, National Cyber Policy Office, CERT New Zealand, DIA. You know, everybody's there is really mission focused. And actually, you know, coming to CyberCX, I've really found that at CyberCX as well. We have a lot of, you know, ex law enforcement, ex military, ex intelligence people, and everyone's really focused on the mission. So so that's super cool.
Yeah, we probably run out of time to sort of, you know, delve into NCSC and sort of CERT coming together. But your thoughts, is that a good move for New Zealand to see these two entities be one?
Yeah, look, I'm on record as saying that I think it's a good idea. I think, you know, having two agencies fulfilling very similar, you know, functions within a small jurisdiction like New Zealand was always going to cause a few issues with overlap. I think for me, the thing that, you know, we really want to see within the cybersecurity industry is, you know, what's the plan? Like, what does it look like going forward? What sorts of services can we expect out of the NCSC, CERT, NZ, you know, merged entity? What does that sort of look like? And I know, you know, they're working on that right now. So I'd expect, you know, over the next sort of 2-4 months, there might be some more information out there available. But, you know, broadly, a very positive thing.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I'd be on the same page on that one. So, yeah, that's good to hear. Well, that's us for this episode. So thanks, everyone, for listening in and joining us on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Of course, a big thank you to our show partners, 2 Degrees Spark, HP, 1NZ, and Gorilla Technology. If you have been watching the live stream, just make sure fire up whatever you listen to audio through, be it, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc., a favorite podcast app. Look up for the NZ Tech Podcast there. That's a great place. You can subscribe for free, of course. And for those that are listening into the audio, which tends to be the bulk of our audience, of course, you know, look out for us on your favorite video platform. We do tend to stream most weeks on a Tuesday afternoon. Some variations. If I'm under the weather or other things happen, but most weeks that tends to be a Tuesday afternoon, and you can find us by following myself on LinkedIn, also NZ Tech Podcast across YouTube, X, and Facebook. So thanks everyone, and thank you, Dan. Great to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Paul.
Anyone that wants to sort of, you know, connect or is looking for help, what's the best way to get in touch?
Well, if you go to cybersecx.co.nz, you'll find us. I'm on LinkedIn, Dan Richardson on LinkedIn. You'll find me. If you're a LinkedIn user, I don't do Twitter, unfortunately, but yeah, you'll find us.
Excellent. Mm. All right, that's great. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay. Cheers.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast. Brought to you by Gorilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.